Good day, Sun Sound listeners. This is Jana Martin. I'll be reading portions of the Arizona Daily Star. It is Wednesday, May 28th, 2025. A story by Tony Davis of the Arizona Daily Star. Water losses accelerate across the Colorado River Basin. The rate of water losses in the seven-state Colorado River Basin has tripled in the past decade, mainly due to intensifying groundwater overpumping in southeast and northwest Arizona, a study finds. The study, written by researchers at Arizona State University and elsewhere, explored the magnitude and causes of water losses in rivers and aquifers, along with melting snows and moistures in soils. It concludes that while public and official attention has been mainly focused on the decline in Lakes Mead and Powell and other surface water reservoirs, losses of groundwater to pumping levels far in excess of what is naturally recharged has been more severe. Generally, groundwater depletion is a bigger threat to Arizona's water supplies than the pressures on the Colorado River, said the study's senior author, ASU professor Jay Familetti. In a departure from many academic studies, this one takes a nod toward advocacy. It calls for more groundwater management to ensure a long-term, sustainable supply. It even suggested federal oversight may be necessary to ensure proper state groundwater management. The work suggests that in some states like Arizona, where only 80% of the area of the state has groundwater management, that expansion of groundwater management across the entire state is a critical step towards preserving this precious resource for future generations and for a long-term economic vitality in the region, Falcomani told the Arizona Daily Star in an email. The current patchwork approach to groundwater management in the U.S. hasn't been enough to ensure long-term sustainability of the groundwater supply, the study says. In regions like Arizona and California, where reliance on groundwater is constantly increasing, federal oversight may be necessary to ensure that groundwater resources are effectively managed in conjunction with surface water allocations, it concludes. When you look specifically at the southwest U.S., we are running out of water, Familetti said. We need to make sure we preserve the groundwater for our economic security, our food security, and our water security, he said, who is with ASU School of Sustainability and is also science director of ASU's Arizona Water Innovation Initiative. If states aren't going to do it, the federal government has to come in and encourage states to tell states to do it. The study comes as Arizona farmers, other rural residents, environmentalists, county officials, and state agency officials and legislators are locked in a seemingly endless dispute over how to create new groundwater regulations for rural Arizona. While everyone involved agrees the state has a problem with unregulated rural pumping, they can't agree on solutions, particularly on how much farmers should have to cut from the current levels of groundwater pumping. Specifically, the new study finds, based on data gathered via satellites, computer models, and other means, that the entire river basin since 2003 lost nearly 28 million acre feet of groundwater, roughly the amount of water stored in Lake Mead, to overpumping, diversions from the Colorado River and other rivers, and hotter, drier weather. The entire basin lost 2.2 acre feet of fresh water annually from 2015 to 2024. That compared to 690,000 acre feet a year during the previous decade. The fresh water includes all natural water sources available, groundwater, surface water, melted snows, and soil moisture. The groundwater losses were driven primarily by increasing groundwater depletion in southeast and western Arizona. The lost groundwater represents two-thirds of all the water losses in the basin since 2003. The total water loss figure of 42.3 million acre feet includes snowmelt and soil moisture, as well as groundwater and surface water. Most of the total water losses occurred in the drier lower Colorado River Basin. It lost 20.7 million acre-feet of groundwater since 2003. That accounted for 71% of the total water losses in the lower basin in that period, including from surface waters such as the Colorado, Arizona, California, and Nevada make up for the lower Colorado basin. The hotter, drier lower basin states lost far more groundwater during the study period than did the cooler, wetter upper basin states of Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. Groundwater losses were less in large groundwater basins that also had access to surface water compared to those with no surface water. Those groundwater basins include the Tucson and Phoenix active management areas, where the state regulates groundwater pumping and where extensive use of the Central Arizona Project water in the past few decades has reduced pressure on their aquifers. The study didn't break down the surface water or groundwater losses by individual states, but the study's substance and its tone makes it clear that the author saw groundwater pumping in Arizona as key resources of the region-wide water losses. A map included in the study showed that Arizona's greatest groundwater losses have occurred in southeastern Arizona, centered on the Wilcox and Douglas basins, and in La Paz and Mojave counties in west and northwest Arizona. In both areas, out-of-state companies have moved in over the past decade or so and begun pumping large amounts of groundwater to grow alfalfa, other forms of hay and grain, and tree nuts, including pecans and pistachios. Thalmagetti said, "We're already seeing many of the negative effects of this overpumping in the form of land subsidies or ground sinking, fissures and drying residential wells. If something isn't done to better manage aquifers, eventually the groundwater in those areas could become so depleted as to be useless," although he can't predict when, he said. "If groundwater remains unprotected in large swaths of the southwestern United States and continues to disappear, it will dramatically limit food production," he said. "Groundwater is critically important in desert states like Arizona and desert cities like Phoenix and Tucson, and if it disappears, then it becomes an existential crisis. We are on a very dangerous trajectory. We have to take more action, like here in the state of Arizona. I wrote a paper like this 10 years ago, and almost uniformly things are getting worse," he said. "I don't know what it takes to get people to act." In Arizona, legislation to extend groundwater management to rural areas has bogged down in part because Republican opponents of sweeping rural groundwater legislation proposed by Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs have sought to limit future cuts in groundwater use to no more than 10% from current levels. Hobbs and other Democrats have backed legislation that would allow cuts up to 40% over 40 years and accused Republicans in the legislative majority of stonewalling the legislation. But Yuma's Republican Senator Tim Dunn, a key author of less restrictive legislation sought by his party, said the new study doesn't tell him anything he doesn't already know. "We're in a drought. The whole western United States is in a drought." Bob Christie from Capital Media Services writes, "Competing wish lists confront Arizona budget negotiators. With a hard deadline of just over a month before Arizona government shuts down if a new state budget isn't enacted, Republican lawmakers and Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs, or at least her staff, are finally talking. The long delay in starting talks despite the GOP-controlled legislature being in session for nearly 5 months and the July 1st deadline puts pressure on both sides to hammer out a deal quickly. Part of the issue holding up the state of negotiations has been talks about extending Proposition 123. The 2016 voter-approved ballot referral was designed to settle a lawsuit by schools over funding cuts by tapping about $300 million more a year from the state land trust created at statehood to mainly support public schools. Public 123 expires this year, but last week GOP lawmakers decided to wait until next year to send any extension to voters. Part of that decision was because Republicans hoped to include a constitutional change protecting the state's universal school voucher program in any extension. The legislature doesn't need Hobbs to okay the needed ballot referral, and she's opposed to vouchers in general. But a bigger reason for slow walking the budget talks has been the uncertainty about state tax revenue. After the calendar year started with an expected $612 million in new revenue, the legislators, budget analysts, and a group of outside economists lowered the figure to $277 million in mid-April. The change was prompted by concerns that new federal tariffs would affect consumer spending and related tax collections. Probable federal spending cuts by the Trump administration are also an issue. Fears of a potential recession also contributed to the lower revenue estimate. Those changes resulted in a prediction for only a tiny surplus of 2% in the expected $17.6 billion budget for the coming year. Since then, concerns about tariffs have moderated slightly. Then, April's tax collections numbers came in with much higher than expected, $207 million higher, mainly due to a big increase in individual income tax payments. That news, released last week, gives some unexpected breathing room. Although the legislature's budget analysts cautioned that budget negotiations should not count on that as ongoing revenue, that's because much of the higher income tax revenues was driven by a surge in capital gains as people locked in stock profits late last year before President Donald Trump took office. I think everybody understands where the economy is, the fragile nature of the economy, and then also the potential impacts from federal administration decisions, House Speaker Steve Montenegro said Tuesday. So I think we all understand that the numbers are flat here in Arizona, said the Goodyear Republican. We all see that there isn't a lot of room here. There isn't a lot of room for spending. Senator John Kavanaugh, Republican from Fountain Hills, said Friday that formal budget talks could begin this week, although as of Tuesday, none had been scheduled. Hobbs is looking at the looming deadline as well. We've started informal conversations this week, she said last Thursday, so I'm hopeful we can meet the 40-day deadline that's in front of us. That hard deadline keeps ticking away. As of Tuesday, just 34 days remain before a government shutdown, if a budget isn't passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. Hobbs rolled out her proposed spending plan for the budget year that starts July 1st in January, but has been frustrated because GOP lawmakers have not presented any outline of their own priorities, other than rejecting for the third year her proposal to roll back the state's universal school voucher program. The governor has been calling on the legislature to put their plan for months and months and months. Her press aide, Christian Slater, said, "Now we're down to the wire, and now we have to get something done." Hobbs released an updated version of that budget in early March that asked for nearly $50 million in supplemental funding to cover the ballooning costs of the voucher program for the balance of this fiscal year. That ends June 30th. The program adopted in 2022 is now on track to cost $1 billion in the coming budget year, even as the governor has unsuccessfully pushed to cut its scope. She said last week that she's working toward a bipartisan budget deal. "We're still looking at what priorities we can include that will get the votes we need to get a bipartisan budget," Hobbs said. Kavanaugh said GOP lawmakers are eyeing just over $250 million in new spending to split between the governor's office and Republican members of the House and the Senate, setting the revenue bar lower than many expected. Splitting the new revenue between the GOP and Democratic wish lists is a new tack that emerged for the first time after Hobbs took in 2023 as the first non-Republican chief executive since Democrat Janet Napolitano left in 2009. Kavanaugh said state Republicans will collectively get about $90 million to spend, with an identical amount divided up between House Republicans. Under the plan, Hobbs would also get $90 million, but minority Democrats in the House and Senate aren't included in Kavanaugh's spending math. The House, however, isn't on board with the Senate plan, according to Republican Matt Gress, a Republican from Phoenix who sits on the House Appropriations Committee. One of the challenges with the 90-90-90 plan is that there are several items in the executive budget that are the basic functioning of government, Gress said, such as replacing air conditioning at prisons, repairing school buildings, or buying new state police vehicles. There are these basic things that you've got to do as government. That costs lots of money, Gress said. So when you do the 90-90-90, it basically gives the executive $90 million to use on things that I think are the responsibility of all of us, the House, the Senate, and the governor. That is wrong, he said. The governor also has other executive initiatives, he said. Things on her own wish list, just like the House and Senate Republicans. So she'll blow through her $90 million in 2 seconds just on covering the basic costs of government. The things that Gress, who brought budget director under Republican former Governor Doug Ducey, said should be the responsibility of the entire government. And Hobbs just has things she wants. Her January budget proposal includes new spending that far exceeds what Kavanaugh said GOP lawmakers have earmarked, including $112 million in new general fund spending to provide child care subsidies for an additional 25,000 children. Subsidies help low-income Arizonans pay for child care so parents can work. She also wants nearly $50 million in new spending for college scholarships for potential nurses, teachers, and other groups, more money for the Housing Trust Fund that helps pay for low-income homes and apartments, and money for the first-time home buyer program, among other spending proposals. She also wants his raises for prison guards and state police and money to combat fentanyl smuggling and for border enforcement. Kavanaugh didn't specify any potential uses for the money he said Republican lawmakers want to spend outside the normal spending increases, including to the budget baseline, and depositing money into a state employee health care fund and one for school building repairs. We want to take care of the baseline and basically divvy up $280 million three ways between the governor, the House, and the Senate, he said. Hobbs also wants to allocate $30 million for raises for state troopers and correction officers, something Gress said is backed by House Republicans as well. Another concern is the state Medicaid program that provides medical care for about a quarter of Arizona's residents. Although the Arizona Health Care Cost Containment System, known as ACCESS, has seen an 8% decrease in enrollment in the past year, those still on the program are sicker and cost more money. That means higher per person costs that the state has to pay the private insurers who manage the system. Add into that a boost in use for a relatively new program that pays parents to care for their seriously disabled children at home, and Medicaid spending. So the Medicaid programs are a significant chunk of this new spending for the governor, and again, those have to be shared by all of us, Gress said. All of those needs and wants and many more go into a budget plan, and neither side will get everything they hope for out of a state budget, especially when money is fairly tight. But Gress said the time running short, it's time for serious talk. Our lines of communications are open with the Senate and the executive, Gress said. We need to get this budget passed, and you do it by assembling the votes, he said. And you've seen two bipartisan budgets pass in fiscal years 24 and 25. And I would expect the same to be the case in 2026, Montenegro said. The House is focused on public safety, ensuring the economy is sound, and individual rights. He downplayed the difference in the budget plans between being pushed by the Senate and the House, saying they will come together. Ultimately, we are all on the same page, and we will be on the same page, Montenegro said. Kavanaugh said he doesn't know when a budget will come together, but knows it must be within the remaining 34 days or else, since Gress has a personal commitment that will mean he's not available after June 22nd. Things could go quick or slow. Is fairly unpredictable, Kavanaugh said. The front page of the paper, this really cute picture from the Children's Museum. And up on the walls, they have major organs like a lung and a big, huge nose and a heart. And in the picture is a little boy with his head going up. He's reaching his arm in apparently, and he's got his head going up into the nostril of the nose. Valor Davidson sticks his arm up a giant nose sculpture at the Children's Museum, which will officially open its Angel Charity for Children Education Center this week nearby at 130 South Scott Avenue, said Teresa Trulson, the museum's marketing director. The Trump administration asked the Supreme Court on Tuesday to halt an order allowing migrants to challenge their deportations to South Sudan, hours after the judge suggested the administration was manufacturing chaos and said he hoped reason can get the better of rhetoric. In the order published Monday evening, Judge Brian Murphy wrote that he gave the Trump administration remarkable flexibility with minimal oversight in the case and emphasized the numerous times he had tried to work with the government. From the course of conduct, it is hard to come to any conclusion other than that the defendants invite a lack of clarity as a means of evasion, the Boston-based Murphy wrote in a 17-page order. Russian forces captured four border villages in Ukraine's northeastern Sumy region, a local official said Tuesday, days after Russian President Vladimir Putin said he ordered troops to establish a buffer zone along the border. King Charles III said Canada is facing unprecedented challenges in a world that's never been more dangerous, as he opened the Canadian Parliament on Tuesday with a speech widely viewed as a show of support in the face of annexation threats by U.S. President Donald Trump. In Poland, the Conservative Political Action Conference, the United States' premier conservative gathering, held its first meeting in Poland on Tuesday, just 5 days before a presidential election between a major liberal mayor and a conservative backed by the U.S. President Donald Trump. "We need you to elect the right leader," U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said in a speech at the event. U.S. Senator David McCormick said Tuesday that an arrangement that will allow Japan-based Nippon Steel to invest in U.S. Steel will guarantee an American CEO, a majority of board members from the United States, and U.S. government approval over certain corporate functions. Gaza's starving search food garbage for food. With flies buzzing all around them, the woman and her daughter pick through the pile of garbage bags for scraps of food at the foot of a destroying building in Gaza City. She found a small pile of cooked rice, a few scraps of bread, a box with some smears of white cheese still inside. Islam Abu Tamini picked soggy bits from a piece of bread and put the dry part in her sack. She will take what she found back to the school where she and hundreds of other families live, boil it, and serve it to her five children, she said. "We're dying of hunger," she said. "If we don't eat, we'll die." Her rummaging for food is a new sign of the depths of desperation in Gaza, where Israel's nearly three-month blockade pushed the population of about 2.3 million towards famine. The entry of a small amount of aid in the past week has done almost nothing to ease the situation. Before the war, it was rare to see anyone searching through garbage for anything, despite the widespread poverty in the Gaza Strip. Since Israel launched its military campaigns decimating the Strip after Hamas's October 7, 2023 attacks, it has been common to see children searching through growing, stinking piles of uncollected garbage for wood or plastic to burn in their family's cooking fire or for anything worth selling, but not for food. For food, they must search through the rubble of damaged buildings, hoping for abandoned canned goods. But Abu Tamazi said she has no options left. She and her nine-year-old daughter wandered around Gaza City looking for the leftovers discarded in trash. "This is our life day to day," she said. "If we don't gather anything, then we don't eat." It's still not common, but now people picking food from trash are occasionally seen. Some come out after dark because of the shame. I feel sorry for myself because I'm educated, and despite that, I'm eating from the trash, she said. She has a bachelor's degree in English from Al-Quds Open University in Gaza. Her family struggled to get by even before the war, she said. She worked for a short time in the past as a secretary for UNRWA, the main UN agency for Palestine's refugees and the biggest employer in Gaza. She also worked as a reader for blind people. Her husband worked briefly as a security guard for UNRWA. He was wounded in 2021 war between Hamas and Israel, and since then has been unable to work. Israel cut off all food, medicine, and other supplies to Gaza on March 2nd. It said the blockade and subsequent resumption of the war aimed to pressure Hamas to release the hostages it still holds. Warnings of famine stoked international criticism of Israel. It allowed several hundred trucks into Gaza last week, but much of that hasn't reached the population, either because aid trucks were looted or because of Israel's military restrictions on aid workers' movements, especially in northern Gaza, according to the UN. Aid groups said the amount of supplies allowed in is nowhere near enough to meet the mounting needs. Abu Tamani and her family fled their home in the Shaiti refugee camp on the northern side of Gaza City in November 2023. At the time, she and one of her children were wounded in a tank shelling, she said. They first headed to the Strip's southernmost city, Rafah, where they were sheltered in a tent for 5 months. Then they moved to the central town of Deir al-Balah a year ago when Israel first invaded Rafah. During a 2-month ceasefire that began in January, they went back to Shati, but their landlord refused to let them back into the apartment because they couldn't pay rent, she said. Several school term shelters in Gaza City at first refused to receive them because they were designated for people who fled towns in northern Gaza. Only when she threatened to set herself and her family on fire did one school give them a space, she said. Abu Tamani said her family can't afford anything in the market where prices skyrocketed and the little food that remains on sale. She said she tried going to a charity kitchen, but they ran out of food before she could get any. The minimal food distribution turns chaotic. Chaos erupted on the second day of aid operations by a new U.S.-backed group in Gaza as desperate Palestinians overwhelmed a center distributing food Tuesday, breaking through fences. Nearby Israeli troops fired warning shots, sending people fleeing in panic. An Associated Press journalist positioned some distance away heard Israel tank and gunfire and saw a military helicopter firing flares. The Israeli military said its troops fired warning shots outside the center and control over the situation was established. At least 3 injured Palestinians were seen by the AP being brought from the scene, one of them bleeding from a leg. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which Israel slated to take over aid operation, opened the distribution hub outside Gaza's southernmost city, Rafah, the prior day. The UN and other humanitarian organizations rejected the new system, saying it won't be able to meet the needs of Gaza's 2.3 million residents and allows Israel to use food as a weapon to control the population. They also warned of the risk of friction between Israeli troops and people seeking supplies. Palestinians are desperate for food after nearly 3 months of an Israeli blockade. Palestinians at the scene said small numbers of people made their way to the GHF center Tuesday morning and received food boxes. As word spread, hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children walked for miles from sprawling tent camps along the Gaza's Mediterranean coast to reach the hub. They had to pass through nearby Israeli military positions. At the center, they waited in long, slow lines in fenced corridors. 2 people said each person was searched and had their faces scanned for identification for being allowed to receive the boxes. Crowds swelled and turmoil erupted, with people tearing down fences and grabbing boxes. The staff at the site were forced to flee, they said. Crowds were seen running from the site. A few people managed to secure aid boxes containing basic items like sugar, flour, pasta, and tahini, but the vast majority left empty-handed. GHF said their staff fell back to allow the crowds to dissipate, then later resumed operations. Attorney General Chris Mays wants to stop a coalition of farmers, ranchers, and cities from trying to block her bid to curb the pumping of groundwater by a Saudi-owned alfalfa farm in western Arizona. In a new court filing Tuesday, Mays said her lawsuit against Fodamonte is about a single company she contends is violating the state's public nuisance law by pumping so much water that it's harming others in the area. She hopes to use that law to limit pumping, given her own admissions that nothing the company is doing violates other statutes dealing with groundwater. Fodamonte has denied breaking any laws. But as the case awaits trial, opponents calling themselves the Arizona Farm and Ranch Group want to have a say in the case. They want to argue that Mays has no right to sue Fodamonte. Maricopa Superior County Judge Scott Minder should toss the request. Assistant Arizona General Clifton Garrett said in a new filing Tuesday, the outcome of this case will have no legal effect on any of the others to defend the rights of Fodamonte to continue what the state contends is excessive pumping, Garrett said. The state alleges that Fodamonte is creating a public nuisance by consuming the majority of the water-constrained Rennegears Basin groundwater supply and thereby causing dry wells and land subsidence, he told the judge. On the opinion page, there's an opinion from the Boston Herald. Normalizing illegal entry helps no one. Democratic governors agree Trump makes a lot of sense on securing the U.S. border. Massachusetts Governor Mara Healey committed an act of Democratic heresy recently, saying, "I think that some of what Donald Trump has done on the border makes a lot of sense." I won't get into specifics, but the general move in recognition that there needed to be more control brought to the border is absolutely correct. And certain things have been done that make a lot of sense, she told reporters. It's surprising that the State House dome didn't topple. Healy knows about the border crisis firsthand. All Bay starters do thanks to former President Joe Biden's porous border policies. An influx of immigrants hit Massachusetts in waves, and the state spent over $1 billion to house and care for them in emergency shelters. Healy said she raised the issue with the former president. Biden did eventually limit border crossings, but it was a little too little, too late. Democrats weren't always always so hands-off with illegal immigrants. Remember how former President Barack Obama earned the deporter-in-chief ID? His administration deported 2.4 million people from 2009 to 2014, including a record 435,000 in 2013, according to a Pew Research Center analysis. He took some heat from immigration activists and politicians, but no one called him a fascist. Then came President Trump, and deportation became a four-letter word, which is why Healy's shout-out is so surprising, because it acknowledges that there was a problem, and it's good that someone is finally doing something about it. There was, of course, a but. There are certain things that Trump's administration is doing now that don't make sense, Healy said. Nobody in the country should have ICE come into their home or into a place of work without due process rights, right? And I think that's a real problem right now. They've just gone too far in terms of the issue of immigration, and that's creating incredible fear and a lot of heartache and anxiety, she said. Obama faced similar criticism, with the American Civil Liberties Union writing in 2014, the Obama administration has prioritized speed over fairness in the removal system, sacrificing individualized due process in the pursuit of record removal numbers. People who entered the U.S. illegally are living on borrowed time, navigating life here without visas or other documentation. They can find work, usually low paid and arduous, get driver's licenses, and enroll their children in schools. But a secure hold is out of reach unless they take steps to become lawful permanent residents with a green card and later apply for naturalizations. Millions of immigrants have come to America illegally, taking the necessary steps to become citizens. If advocates really want to end the fear faced by illegal immigrants, they should help them get back on the right track to legal citizenship. There is an opinion by Allison Schrager, who is a Bloomberg columnist and senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. It is entitled, America's Debt Problem is Also Retirement Problem. The Wise Minds and Moody's Investor Service finally acknowledged recently what the other two main credit rating agencies did years ago. America has a debt problem. Now it's time for America to recognize that solving its debt problem will require addressing another hard truth. Americans have a retirement problem. Specifically, they retire too soon. Despite reports that Moody's decision is related to the fiscal impact of the $3.7 trillion tax legislation the House approved last week, that bill is just the proverbial rearranging of deck chairs on the Titanic. The biggest source of America's long-term debt problem, which is not even included in the 10-year budget projections, is unfunded entitlements, largely Social Security and Medicare. For some reason, it has become considerably politically wise for both Republicans and Democrats to promise they won't touch Social Security. This is not realistic. Within the next 10 years, the program won't be able to pay full benefits. Something has to change. The retirement age. Americans like to make fun of the French for their early retirements, but many Americans also retire in their early 60s. In many states, retiring at 62 is the norm. Since the reform of Social Security in the 1980s, the normal retirement age at which people qualify for full benefits has been creeping up from 65 to 67, depending on when you were born. Further financial incentives encourage delaying retirement until age 70. Because of these enticements and the longer and healthier lifespans for many Americans, the average retirement age has started to creep up. But most Americans do not take advantage of later retirement. Social Security's early retirement age, 62, remains unchanged. More than one-third of Americans and nearly 40% of women retire early. This is not entirely by choice. Age discrimination is real. Someone who loses their job after age 60 can find it very hard to get another one. Some people also have physically demanding jobs they can't do into their 60s. Still, organizing the retirement system around a minority of the population doesn't make sense. Just because some people can't work at age 62 doesn't mean the option of retiring at that age should be available to everyone. Those who need to retire early can be better served by Social Security's existing disability program. For everyone else, the early retirement age should be gradually increased to 65 over the next decade. More can also be done to make older workers make appealing to employers, especially around health benefits, since most older workers qualify for Medicare. Of course, raising early retirement will not in and of itself close the entire Social Security funding gap. If it were increased and then indexed to life expectancy and the normal retirement age was as well, and depending on the details, then the long-term shortfall would be reduced by anywhere between 14 and 50%. Raising the early retirement age would also be regressive because richer people tend to live longer, while early retirement is more common in low-income states. That's why an increase in the early retirement age should be paired with a 2.5% payroll tax increase on earnings above $250,000. It is tempting to dismiss the Moody's downgrades as non-news. The debt problem isn't new, and the rating agency has lost a lot of credibility in recent decades, but is an opportunity for an honest politician to level with American people. The country's debt problem is bigger than the latest budget or tax bill. It starts and ends with entitlements, and addressing the problem will require Americans not only to pay more taxes, but also to retire later in life. In a letter to the editor, Roger Ulrich from the Northwest Side says, Saguaro show puzzling? Need more data? How about focusing on heat and drought stress? This is Mother Nature's way to prolong the species in dire times by increasing their seed count in the hope some will survive with a better future. Flowers of happiness? I think not. Charles Bloomer on the Northeast Side writes, a plea for local businesses. My wife had lunch recently at a restaurant on East Grant Road. Her server lamented at the decline in business due to the massive construction project in front of the restaurant. It may not be as convenient as it once was, but your patronage matters. It makes all the difference. The national chains will survive regardless, but our local businesses need you more than ever. The sports section, Arizona football, former Wildcat signs with the Steelers, a story by Justin Spears of The Star. Former Arizona wide receiver Montana Lemonnaise Craig signed with the Pittsburgh Steelers for fall training camp, the franchise announced Tuesday morning. Lemonnaise Craig will be on Pittsburgh's 90-man roster and fight for a spot on the 53-man roster leading up to the season opener against the New York Jets on September 7th. Lemonnaise Craig is the sixth Wildcat from the 2024 UA squad to land with an NFL team, joining Territory McMillan, Carolina Panthers, offensive lineman Jonah Salvania, Miami Dolphins, kicker Tyler Loop, the Baltimore Ravens, running back Jacroy Krosky Merritt, Washington Commodores, and undrafted running back Quail Conley, the Cincinnati Bengals. The two-year starter had 45 receptions for 468 yards and four touchdowns in 24 games for the Wildcats. Lemono Craig's production tapered off in his final season in 2024 as Chris Hunter III ascended into a more prominent role in Arizona's offense. The 6'2", 194-pound Lemonnaise Craig started his career at Colorado before transferring to Arizona for the final two seasons of his collegiate career. At CU, the Inglewood, California native recorded 34 catches for 497 yards and five touchdowns. Lemonnaise Craig joins a Steeler wide receiver room that traded for Pro Bowler DK Metcalf and signed veterans Robert Woods in the offseason. After trading George Pickens to the Dallas Cowboys earlier this month, the Steelers have slot receivers Kelvin Austin III and Scotty Miller, along with Roman Wilson and Rock Taylor, among them. Pittsburgh's training camp begins on July 26th at St. Vincent College in La Trobe, Pennsylvania. From the French Open, Novak Djokovic experienced the lowest of lows, pulling out of the French Open after tearing the meniscus in his right knee, and the highest of highs, winning a long-sought Olympic gold medal for Serbia at Roland Garros last year. This trip to the site went smoothly once he got going. Other than some first set interruptions by and lengthy discussions about the windy, wet weather, and the 24-time major champion was unbothered during a 6-3, 6-3, 6-3 victory over 98th-ranked Mackie McDonald of the United States at Court Philippe Chatrier in the first round. He makes it seem like a video game almost for him, said McDonald, a 30-year-old Californian who played college tennis at UCLA twice and has been to the fourth round at the Grand Slam tournaments. He's able to just do so much. I don't even think he was playing his best tennis or his highest level, but if I pushed him to a different point, he would bring it up. One example, when McDonald earned his first break points, getting to love 40 at 3-2 in the second set, Djokovic came up with his three big serves, 120 miles per hour, ace, 123 mile per hour ace, and 122 mile per ace service winner. Djokovic compiled 32 winners, 18 more than McDonald, and just 20 unforced errors in a match that eventually was played with the lights on and the retractable roof closed. I'm a competitor and losing stings, McDonald said, but playing Novak on that court is something I'll remember. Before Djokovic, who just turned 38 and won his 100th career title last weekend, walked onto the playing surface, he was identified by the stadium announcer by his total number of slam trophies, the three he's won at the French Open and the Summer Game gold he won here in Paris. I still remember last year's Olympic Games. It was the last time I was here, Djokovic said afterwards. The emotion is very strong. The medal that means so much to him? I don't have the medal with me, but I have a picture of my medal. It's in my bag, he said. The medal is with my father. My dad likes trophies more than I do, so I gave him mine. Frenchman Gael Monfils rallied against two sets down and beat Hugo Dillon of Bolivia 4-6, 3-6, 6-1, 7-6, 4, and 6-1 in a match that lasted more than 3 hours. Monfils was injured on his fifth point of the match when he fell and crashed into a side billboard. The 30-year-old Monfils was moving to his right as he returned a shot into the net. He scraped his hands trying to break his fall and required a few minutes of medical attention before being play resumed. Monfils, ranked 42nd in the world with a history of right knee and leg injuries, was a point away from breaking the 90th ranked Dillon serve and ended up losing the game and going behind 3-0 in the first set. After dropping the second set, Monfils battled back and, helped by a 19-2 advantage in aces, advanced to the second round. What else happened Tuesday? Once Coco Gauff found her rackets, a relatively important piece of equipment for a tennis player, all was well for her in the first round. Gauff showed up on court, opened her bag, and peered inside to find it was missing her rackets. The start of the warm-up was delayed, but then everything went Gauff's way, and the 2023 U.S. Open got past Olivia Gondecki 6-2, 6-2. Unseeded American Alicia Parks, ranked 52 in the world, beat number 14 seed Carolyn Muchova 6-3, 2-6, 6-1 in the women's last matchup of the day. Muchova was the runner-up to Iga Swiatek as Roland Garros in 2023. Other winners include the number 3 seeds Jessica Pegula and Alexander Zverev and the 18-year-old Mira Andavi, but 2021 U.S. Open champion Daniil Medvedev, who was seeded 11th, lost to Cam Nori 7-5, 6-3, 4-6, 1-6, 7-5 across nearly 4 hours. Other seeded men were sent home when 18-year-old Joao Francesca dispatched number 30 Herbert Hukot 6-2, 6-4, 6-2, and when number 16 Gigard Dimitrov quit while leading American qualifier Ethan Quinn, who's 2-1. This is the fourth consecutive major tournament at which Dimitrov retired. The second round began on day 4 with a schedule that includes defending champions Iga Swiatek and Carlos Alcaraz, 2024 runner-up Jasmine Paolini, and two-time finalist Casper Ruud. Swiatek met 2021 U.S. Open champion Emma Raducanu in the day session's last match in the main stadium. Women's professional basketball, the Indiana Fever will be without star guard Caitlin Clark for at least 2 weeks as she deals with a strained left quad. The reigning Rookie of the Year was injured Saturday while playing against New York. If Clark ends up returning in 2 weeks, that would put her on target to be back for the Fever's rematch against New York on June 14th. She missed the games at Washington, Chicago, and Atlanta, as well as home contests against Connecticut and Washington. Then the game Wednesday against the Mystics was moved to the 14,000-seat CFG Bank Arena in Baltimore to accommodate a larger crowd. Capital One Arena in Washington wasn't available because of summer renovation. The game at Chicago on June 7th will be played in the United Center, home of the Bulls, and will be broadcast in primetime on CBS, the first ever for the network of a WNBA game. Joseph Blair has garnered many titles throughout his life: Arizona Wildcat, professional basketball player, Harlem Globetrotter, and now NBA coach. No matter the changes in Blair's life, the one constant in his life was being a mama's boy. The former Arizona basketball star, in partnership with the city of Tucson, is attempting to raise $250,000 for two outdoor basketball courts at Palo Verde Park near Broadway and Culb Road, and is naming the site the Judith Blair Memorial Basketball Courts after his late mother, who passed away at 71 years old in 2019 following a battle with lung cancer. Donations for the basketball courts can be made at judithblaircourts.com. The ribbon-cutting ceremony for the Judith Blair Memorial Basketball Courts is slotted for May 2026. This is just a great opportunity to play homage to my mom and her love for the city and community of Tucson and her love for basketball as well, Joseph Blair said. It's just a great project. If anyone wants to jump on and donate some money to it, I need some help. The city is putting up some bond money, but I need to raise money on my own side. Tips for building an entourage as you age. If it takes a village to raise a child, it can take a small town to support an aging adult. As we get older, the range of professionals and services we rely on for physical, financial, and daily living support expands and shifts. There are your entourage as you age. Who will be your entourage? The people and services that support you fall into these categories. Number one, healthcare. For much of your life, you may have gotten by with just a primary care doctor and possibly a therapist for mental health care. In retirement, you'll likely add specialists such as an ophthalmologist, a dermatologist, a physical therapist. Later in life, you develop conditions that require a cardiologist, gastrointestinal doctor, rheumatologist, pulmonologist, or oncologist. Two, finances. You may enlist someone or manage your nest egg, whether that's an independent financial planner or a mutual fund company. An accountant or tax preparer may assist you as in paying Uncle Sam each April. At some point, you might rely on a family member or trusted advisor to manage paying bills and sorting through correspondences. Three, fitness and wellness. Should you hire a personal trainer or attend exercise classes at an upscale gym or local community center? These are the kinds of decisions you'll make around fitness at your age. Number four, home care. Outside help may begin as a want, but it becomes a need for those who age in place. Indeed, less than 10% of seniors plan to move into retirement community, according to Colin Milner, chief executive of the International Council on Active Aging. We have to start adopting these different services providers early on, he says. Five, personal care. The basic activities of daily life, which can trigger long-term care insurance benefits when you can no longer perform them on your own, including bathing, dressing and grooming, going to the toilet, getting into a better chair, feeding yourself, and walking. Six, food. The possibilities range from a personal shopper or chef to simply using delivery service of your local grocery store. Seven, fun and friends. Don't overlook friends or potential friends. You can cultivate neighborhood friendships by hosting potlucks or offering to help bring packages inside. These nearby relations can be sources of support in an emergency as you age. 8. Transportation. As you age, transportation options may become limited by vision, hearing, or mobility challenges. When a family member or a paid driver takes you on errands and to doctor's visits, they're part of your entourage. Explore public transit options in your city. 9. Communication technology. From Amazon to Walmart, almost anything can be delivered to your doorstep. However, if navigating that technology becomes overwhelming, seniors can quickly be cut off. The Geek Squad or other in-person technology support services can help you fix your computer or electronic bugs. Your local library may also provide tech classes and hands-on help, and many consumer electronic companies have online telephone support. There's also a recipe for salt and pepper pork chops with spicy scallions. For the ingredients, you'll need one bunch of scallions, thinly sliced, 1 cup of lightly packed cilantro, roughly chopped, 1 Fresno or jalapeno chili, stem seeded and minced, 2 tablespoons unseasoned rice vinegar, 1 tablespoon finely grated fresh ginger, kosher salt and ground pepper, 3 tablespoons cornstarch, 1 tablespoon Szechuan peppercorns finely ground, or 1 teaspoon cayenne pepper, teaspoon of Chinese 5-spice powder, 8 boneless, about 1 pound, thin cut pork loin chop cutlets, they're to 1/4 inch thick and patted dry, 1/3 cup grapeseed or other neutral oil. Directions: in a medium bowl, toss together the scallions, cilantro, chili, vinegar, ginger, and 1/4 teaspoon salt. Set aside in a wide, shallow dish. Mix together the cornstarch, Szechuan pepper, cayenne pepper, 5 spice, 2 teaspoons black pepper, and 1 teaspoon salt. Dredge the cutlets in the cornstarch mixture, turning to coat both sides and pressing so the mixture adheres, and then transfer to a large plate, stacking or shingling as needed. In a 12-inch nonstick skillet over medium-high heat, heat the oil until it's barely smoking. Then add 1/2 of the cutlets and cook until browned on the bottom, 2 to 3 minutes. Using tongs, flip the cutlets and cook until golden brown on the second half, about another minute. Transfer to a platter and tent the foil. Cook the remaining cutlets in the same way, using the oil remaining in the skillet. Spoon the scallion cilantro mixture onto the chops and serve. Today, it will be mainly sunny to start, then a few clouds in the afternoon with a high of 100 degrees with winds from the south-southwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, it will be partly cloudy with a low of 67 with winds shifting to the south-southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Intervals of clouds and sunshine with a high of 97 tomorrow with winds from the southwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. On Wednesday, it's expected to get up to 100. On Thursday, 97. But don't get depressed. It's going to get cooler. On next Sunday, we'll have a high of 83 degrees. And Monday, a high of 88. So it looks like we'll have an upcoming good weekend. Take care. Have a good week. Goodbye.